Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, this is an English-speaking event, as you know, so let's make that sure from the beginning. On behalf of the Freer School of Language and Literature, it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce to you Professor Kendall Lewis Walton from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, one of the great American state universities, famous university indeed. Professor Kendall Walton, who's without any doubt one of the most renowned aesthetic philosophers and literary theorists of our time. Professor Walton received his BA from the University of California at Berkeley and his PhD from Cornell University with a doctoral dissertation on conceptual schemes, a study of linguistic relativity and related philosophical problems. He has since held the positions of lecturer, assistant professor, associate professor, and full professor at the University of Michigan since 1965, so he's enormously faithful to his university. He stayed there all the time. He's at present now the Charles L. Stevenson Collegiate Professor of Philosophy, and at the same time professor at the School of Art and Design of the University of Michigan. Among the many honors that Professor Walton has received, let me just mention the invitation to hold the Carl Hempel Lectures at Princeton University in 1991, the nomination to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences as its fellow, elected in 1998, or his function as president of the American Society for Aesthetics from 2003 to 2005. Professor Walton holds an honorary doctor's degree of the University of Nottingham, conferred on him in July 2005, and has recently been invited for an international visiting research fellowship at Sydney University in 2009. So, although he's so faithful to his own university, he's also a great traveler and a figure of truly international stature. It seems that Wanderlust is his most cherished word in German. I learned it from him, actually. I thought it was Reiselust, but Wanderlust seems so much more beautiful indeed. Well, much of Professor Walton's work consists in exploring connections between theoretical questions about the arts and issues of the philosophy of mind, of metaphysics, and the philosophy of language. His book is very famous book, Mimesis as Make-Believe on the Foundations of the Representational Arts, develops a theory of make-believe, I think the most elaborate theory that we have on this subject, and uses it to understand the nature and varieties of representation in the arts. And as some of you will know, representation and knowledge in language and literature are the central topic of our Freer School for the next three years, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that Professor Walton's book on mimesis and representation is probably the most substantial contribution to the field, so it's an enormous gain for us to have him here tonight. But at the same time, Professor Walton has written extensively on pictorial representation, on fiction and the emotions, on the ontological status of fictional entities, the aesthetics of music, of metaphor, and about aesthetic value. His most recent book, published earlier this year, Marvelous Images, collects essays on the values and the arts. And there is yet another book in the pipeline due to appear by the end of this year in Oxford University Press, entitled In Other Shoes, and dealing, among other things, with philosophical aspects of music, which is only natural since Professor Walton is an accomplished musician, a cellist himself. Tonight's lecture belongs into the context of this book in print, and it is entitled Poets as Thought Writers, Music Without Personae, quite a fascinating title indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Kendall Walton, and yes, Ken, thank you for coming all the way from Lake Michigan and from America in general, which seems to be so much more exciting place these days than old Europe and cold Germany. We're very happy to have you here and are looking forward to your lecture. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much, Werner. It's great to be here. I apologize and I'm a little embarrassed that I'm not able to give the talk in German, but I'm impressed with how many of you come to a talk in English. Actually, for me, Europe is more exciting than America, so it's probably, it depends on where you spend all your time. The arts are customarily divided into several broad categories, two of which are no doubt literature and music. Third, I guess, is the visual arts. Could I ask first, can everyone hear me? Is there any problem? You can hear me in the back? I assume you can. Okay, good. Several broad categories of art, two of them are literature and music, and as the third, I guess, is the visual arts. Literature, we might call it the word arts, includes novels, stories, and poetry. In my Mises and Make-Believe and elsewhere, I treated these literary forms mostly together, usually using novels and stories as my examples, but thinking or assuming normally, or for most of the time, that what I said about novels and stories would, for the most part, go for poetry as well. I should have been alert to significant differences between poetry, some poetry at least, and novels and stories. Poetry, at least some of it, belongs much more naturally with music in important respects than with other literary forms. This should not be surprising, given the intertwined histories of these arts. It's arguable that in the murky ancient past, when poetry was almost always spoken, it was hardly distinguishable from song, which then was probably the dominant form of music. Sound is important in poetry, as it is in music, of course, and much less so ordinarily in the novel, likewise for meter and rhythm. But I'm interested now in another respect in which poetry is like music and unlike the novel and other forms of literature. Bringing out this similarity will require rethinking the nature and function of poetry and also resisting a recent trend in philosophers and musical theorists' understanding of musical expressiveness. I begin with a sweeping claim about all of the arts, advanced by a well-known musicologist or music theorist, Edward Cohn. Quote, "Each art in its own way projects the illusion of the existence of a personal subject through whose consciousness a certain kind of experience is made known to the rest of us. That is the role of the character in a play, of the narrator in a novel, of the persona in a lyric." Edward Cohn's main point is that this applies to music, that there are musical personae which function somewhat as narrators in novels and speakers of lyric poems do. He doesn't have in mind just the vocal line of songs like Schubert's Erl König. Persona are to be found in all music, he thinks. The piano accompaniment of Erl König has its own persona, he thinks, and there are personae in all purely instrumental music. He mentions a fugue in Bach's Second Brandenburg Concerto. On this picture, appreciation of all of the arts, including instrumental music and all literature, novels and stories as well as poetry, centrally involves recognizing, engaging with, and responding to another person, a fictional person, if not an actual one. Most of us will have little trouble with Cohn's claim about literature, with the notion that most, if not all, literary works have narrators. But special cases aside, it's by no means obvious that there's anything like narrators in instrumental music. I have worries about both, about literature as well as music. I'll propose an alternative to recognizing narrators in literary works, even in instances in which they seem most obvious. This will suggest a way of understanding instrumental music that does not postulate musical personae, one that is, as it happens, an approximation of one that I proposed previously, which I'll refer to. In non-fictional literature, a real person typically uses the words of the text to communicate with readers, asserting the declarative sentences it contains. Novels, stories, and poems are standardly understood as modeled on such ordinary non-fictional uses of language. They're normally understood as fictional or pretend instances of what we might call, with tongues and cheeks, serious discourse. Literary fictions are created by real persons, of course, but the reader may be more interested in fictional narrators than in actual writers. Narrators are characters who, in the fictional world of the work, speak or write the words of the text seriously, with scare quotes. They speak or write the words of the text seriously, asserting the declarative sentences it contains, and thereby recounting the events of the story. That's what narrators typically do. In some instances, of course, narrators merely think the words of the text without, in the fictional world of the work, uttering them or writing them. The reader's experience of novels, stories, and poems on this familiar picture is in the first instance an experience of recognizing, engaging with, and responding to this fictional person, doing so in imagination at least, and in some instances, of course, empathizing with the narrator. The reader's experience is akin to being addressed by or overhearing a real person speaking or writing seriously. Do all literary works or all literary works of art have narrators? They are more prominent and more important in some works than in others. In some instances, they are effaced, as people say. Some would say to the point of disappearance. In my previous work, I examined, in Mimesis as Make-Believe, I examined very special cases, in particular a novel, Heartbreak Tango, by the Argentine writer Manuel Puig, which might arguably be best understood as lacking a narrator. But in that book, I expressed a preference for recognizing narrators, effaced ones at least, in virtually all literary fictions. This was partly to leave plenty of room for detecting even the slightest hint of expressions of attitude or point of view on the part of the narrator. But that was then. There's an important possibility that I did not think of, a way of understanding literary works, and not just special or unusual cases like Heartbreak Tango, that does not involve in recognizing narrators and need not consist in anything like recognizing and responding to another person. This, I said, is a possible way of understanding literary works. Whether and to what extent this possibility is actual is another question. I doubt that readers' experiences are ever fully or exclusively of the kind I shall describe, but it will be obvious, I think, that they are often partly so. This is a very important dimension of many experiences of poetry, especially one that has been seriously neglected, I think, by philosophers and theorists of literature. One form of literature in which narrators tend not to be effaced, in which they are especially prominent, so it seems anyway, is poetry, and especially lyric poetry. A philosopher, Jennifer Robinson, develops what she calls a new romantic theory of expression in the arts, according to which works expressive of emotions or ideas or attitudes are works in which there is a narrator or persona who expresses the emotions, ideas, or attitudes in question. The theory applies to all of the arts, she thinks, quote, at least to all those artworks that have some claim to be called expressions, end quote. But paradigmatically, she thinks it applies to lyric poetry, most obviously lyric poems in the first person. Her main examples are Keats and Shelley. But it is poetry especially, more than novels and stories, and in particular lyric poetry, where my alternative proposal is most plausible. And I most certainly include lyric poetry in the first person. How could we not think of the words, my heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense as though of hemlock I had drunk, this is from Keats' Ode to a Nightingale. How could we not think of these words as someone's words used seriously? How could we not, when we read them, imagine a person using them to express his or her heartaches? I will explain how in a moment. Robinson allows for several familiar varieties of narrators or personae or poetic speakers in poetry, and I will as well. Sometimes the actual poet is the narrator, as when a poet or someone with poetic pretensions writes in verse an honest-to-God love letter to his real-life beloved. Such a poem is probably not a work of fiction at all. Sometimes the narrator is a fictionalized version of the poet, and some narrators are just plain fictions. Let's not worry about these differences. What's important now is the notion that the words of lyric poems are understood to be written or spoken or perhaps thought by someone, either fictional or actual, someone other than the reader or the listener. What about music? Edward Cohn is not alone in taking narrators and literary works to have analogs and music, pure instrumental music included. Robinson does also, and so does another philosopher, Gerald Levinson. They do so largely in order to account for musical expressions of emotion. All three, Cohn, Robinson, and Levinson, endorse something like the following. Just as narrators in literary works express beliefs, attitudes, intentions, emotions by means of the words of the text, musical personae express emotions, feelings, or attitudes by means of the sounds or the gestures of the music. So listeners' experiences, like those of readers, involve something like recognizing and responding to another person on this account. Levinson proposed a general account of musical expression, which we can gloss as follows. A passage of music expresses a given emotion just in case it is aptly heard as the expression of that emotion by the music's persona. I myself made a suggestion in this direction, in the direction of musical personae many years ago. I proposed that to describe music as anguished, for instance, is to say that it's fictional that the music expresses someone's or something's anguish. I continue to think that some instrumental music, a lyrical passage of a piano sonata, for instance, is naturally and appropriately heard in this way, but it now seems to me that the prevalence and importance of persona in music have been seriously exaggerated. The insight I thought I had about anguished music many years ago was, I now think, very limited. A decade or so after floating the persona idea, I developed an account of a different kind of musical expressiveness that does not rely on anything like musical persona, one that's akin to the proposal about poetry that I'll present shortly. There's an essay by R.K. Eliot, which you may or may not know. The title is Aesthetic Theory and the Experience of Art. It has always struck me as uncommonly perceptive, yet frustratingly obscure. Eliot distinguished between what he called experiencing a work of art from without and experiencing it from within, and he applied these notions to poetry, music, and painting. The clearest application of both of them, actually, is to lyric poetry, and so that's what I'll talk about now. Quote from Eliot, "A poem can be perceived as if it were the speech or thought of another person, and it is possible for us to make this expression our own, for the reader of the poem to make this expression our own. When we do make the expression our own, we are experiencing the poem from within, otherwise we experience it from without." This and other formulations suggest that for Eliot, in both cases, we perceive the poem as the expression of another person, a person with whom we have a third-person relation. The idea may be that in the from-within case, we not only recognize this other person, the poet qua speaker of the poem, and her expressive behavior, but we also empathize with her, imaginatively occupying her shoes and feeling somewhat as she does. We experience an emotion, this is another quotation from Eliot, we experience an emotion through an imaginative assumption of the expression and situation of another person, real or imaginary. I do not merely recognize that the poet is expressing, for example, sadness, but actually feel the sadness. If empathy is what Eliot has in mind, the reader empathizes not just with the poet's situation and her feelings and attitudes, but also with her expressing these feelings and attitudes by means of the words of the text. This means, I take it, that the reader imagines using the words of the poem to express her own feelings or attitudes. One can empathize with a person's feelings or those of another sentient being without empathizing with her way of expressing them. I might feel contentment in imagination or actually as I take a purring cat to feel, or joy while watching a dog wagging its tail, but it's unlikely that I should imagine expressing contentment by purring or joy by wagging my tail. Maybe I could imagine that, but I'm not sure I ever have. There's no challenge yet to the idea that experiencing a poem is fundamentally a matter of recognizing and responding to another person, a possibly fictional speaker of the poem. The reader's experience from within, according to what I've said so far, is triggered by, comes after, and is dependent on the experience from without, the experience of the words of the poem as someone else's expression. There's another way of understanding reader's experience which does challenge this idea, and this is the alternative I promised. Rather than understanding a poem on the model of an ordinary assertive or expressive utterance addressed to or overheard by a listener, we might understand it on the model of a speech written by a speechwriter for use by another person. Speechwriters do not use the words they inscribe, they mention them. They produce a text for use by someone else. The speechwriter does not assert the declarative sentences he comes up with. His client asserts them when she delivers the speech. The client knows where the words came from. She may appreciate and admire the speechwriter's skill and pay him well for his services, but recognizing him is not necessary in order to make use of his words in her speech. The words might have grown on trees or appeared in drifted patterns on a beach, or she might think they did. Once she has the words before her, no matter how they got there, she can use them assertively in her address if she wants to. There are lots of disanalogies between poets and speechwriters, of course. Poems and the speeches speechwriters prepare are immensely different in obvious ways, but the differences are obvious. The similarities I will point to are less obvious, but they are striking nonetheless. So there's more to be learned by focusing on the similarities. Lest we suppose that relying on speechwriters is rare or special or unusual, keep in mind that we learn the language we use from others. Not only do we master its syntax and semantics by witnessing others using it, we also pick up from other speakers and writers pithy phrases, apt metaphors, allegories, hypothetical examples, telling anecdotes, rhetorical tricks, and so on. We don't usually acquire complete speeches from other language users, extended texts of the kind a politician might pay a speechwriter to supply, but we do learn from others combinations of words that may come in handy for our own use as we search for ways to express ourselves in our language. Some examples: nothing succeeds like success, it ain't over till it's over, and if you want to admit that you screwed up without admitting that you screwed up, the thing to say, I've learned from politicians, is mistakes were made. Or you can use the story of the boy who cried wolf, as people do, of course, in lots of cases. Our teachers, other speakers, do not usually speak for the purpose of providing listeners with words to use. They don't get paid. They simply use words themselves, assertively or otherwise. But we need not be concerned with what these speakers were up to. The pithy phrases and so on are there in what might as well be mentions rather than uses, available to be added to our working repertoire for later use. There are more formal cases as well. A judge who says to people getting married or to courtroom witnesses taking the oath, say after me, ... the judge feeds words to the bride and groom or the witness for them to use seriously. So the judge does not use the words, he mentions them. The words are there for use by the bride and groom or the prospective witness. Poems are not trees, but they do contain phrases, sentences, paragraphs, verses, which readers can, if they wish, use themselves. The words are there ripe for picking, no matter what the poet was doing in writing them down, and no matter what the reader takes him to have been doing. People sometimes borrow phrases or sentences from Shakespeare in conversation and informal speech, and I think probably Germans do that about as much as English speakers. So we say things like, to be or not to be, methinks she protests too much, all's well that ends well, and so on. We use words in thinking and formulating thoughts for ourselves, as well as in communicating to others, and words found in a poem or learned from other speakers may come in handy for this purpose also, that is, for articulating our own thoughts. A poet's words might strike me as just the right way of expressing a thought I thought I had, or on reading a poem, I might decide then and there to endorse the thought they express and use the words of the poem to assert it to myself. Alternatively, I may think of the words as clarifying my thoughts as well as providing a means of expressing them. So I will say that poets sometimes serve not exactly as speech writers, but as thought writers. And this probably is the secret of my title being so exciting, because it has a made-up word in it that you've never heard before. My own coinage, thought writers. By thoughts, I should mention, by the way, that I include not just intellectual ideas, but any feelings, emotions, sentiments, attitudes, and so on, which might be expressed by means of words. If I agree with the sentiments expressed by the words of a poem, or find them especially apropos on a particular occasion, I might recite the entire poem, seriously asserting, if only to myself, these sentiments. Think of a person who, finding herself in a tight spot, recites the 23rd Psalm. It is not just while repeating the words of a poem after reading it that I may make use of them in thought. I can use them thinking or saying them assertively to myself, even as I read. When I do, I have the text of my internal speech in front of my eyes. It's not unlikely, it seems to me, that poets sometimes have, as at least part of their purpose in composing a poem, the objective of making words available for use by their readers. They may think of themselves, maybe not very explicitly, as thought writers. That this could be the poet's main or primary purpose, although I'm sure the poets have never called themselves thought writers because they didn't know that word. Insofar as this is the poet's purpose, she need not expect readers to imagine a narrator using the words of the poem, or to suppose that she herself, the author, meant them seriously. The poet may expect the reader merely to recognize her invitation to use the words himself, to recognize her role as a thought writer. The words are there for readers to use no matter what the poet was doing in writing them down, and no matter what readers think she was doing. For this purpose, poems might as well be trees. Suppose this is all that is going on. Consider an unlikely, pure, and simple case in which the poet thinks of herself as just a thought writer. She intends simply to put words into readers' mouths or minds, to give them a text by means of which they can express, articulate, sincerely held opinions. Suppose that this is understood to be the proper and appropriate function of the poem. The poet does not use the words or mean them seriously, and she does not expect readers to recognize a fictional narrator who does. Appreciators then use the text in the expected manner, some do anyway, finding the words suitable for his purposes. The reader genuinely expresses sincerely held convictions by means of them. Does a poem in this pure and unlikely case count as a work of fiction or a work of nonfiction? There need be no imagining at all, no prescriptions to imagine. Nothing is true in the world of the poem. There is no fictional world. The poem just is not a work of fiction, any more than a speech written by a speechwriter is a work of fiction. Is it nonfiction? Well, yes, if that just means that it's not fiction. But it is not a typical work of nonfiction, an ordinary instance of nonfictional literature. The poet, the author of the work, did not use the words, but only mentioned them. She didn't assert its declarative sentences. The reader alone uses the words, if he chooses to do so. In this pure kind of case, the poem does not serve as an actual vehicle of communication, not the usual kind at least, not even a pretended or attempted vehicle of communication. It is not always possible for a reader to use the words of a poem seriously. She might not be in a position to do so. Sometimes she will be unwilling to do so. Consider these words from Edmund Arlington Robinson. Whenever Richard Cory went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean-favored and imperially slim. I am not a homeless street person, a pavement person. nor have I ever known a distinguished gentleman named Richard Corey. So I can hardly use these words sincerely. I might read a poem written in the first person about a deathbed experience when I'm not facing imminent death, or a love poem when I'm not in love or not in love with a person of the sort the poem mentioned in the poem. Few of us are likely to use the words, "'Twas the night before Christmas," and so on, to recount seriously seeing a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer and the rest. If the ideas and or attitudes expressed in a poem are ones the reader does not accept, she may be unwilling to think or utter them assertively and unable to do so sincerely. She might not share the religious convictions expressed in Donne's Holy Sonnet, for instance. Does the reader in these cases have no choice but to read the poem either as another person's serious utterance or as the unusable and perhaps inappropriate handiwork of a speechwriter or a thought writer? Enter the imagination, pretense, role-playing. I'm sure you thought I was going to get to that sometime. The reader may imagine uttering or thinking the words of a poem seriously. He may pretend to do so. I can imagine being a person of the pavement, observing from that lowly perspective a well-dressed gentleman named Richard Corey, and I may use in imagination the words Edwin Arlington Robinson supplied to describe Richard Corey. I might pretend to curse death as I prepare to kick the bucket, or employing John Donne's words, I might pretend to praise God and express confidence in an afterlife. We use the words of the night before Christmas to express a delightful fantasy. If I disagree with the sentiments expressed in the poem, I may try them on, imagining uttering the words seriously to see what it feels like to express such thoughts or attitudes, and probably what it feels like to endorse or accept or adopt them. I need not in any of these cases empathize with anyone, with a fictional person, with a fictional pavement person, or with someone who wholeheartedly endorses the sentiments or accepts the ideas that I try on. I need not recognize anyone, either fictional or actual, to empathize with. Does this imagining or pretense make the work a work of fiction? No. The text itself does not make anything fictional. It does not prescribe any imaginings. It is not fictional by virtue of the words on the page that anyone uses them seriously or at all. What the text does is to invite readers to do so in speech or thought, actually, or in pretense. If a reader does use the words in pretense, he will be engaging in what I call a game of make-believe. It will be fictional in his game that he asserts the declarative sentences in the poem. But nothing is fictional unless and until he does so. So there may be what I called a game world, but not a work world. And this is exactly the situation I envisioned for music, insofar as it's expressive just in the sense that does not involve musical personae. If I disagree strongly enough with the sentiments I would be expressing, should I assert the words of a poem seriously, if I find them sufficiently repugnant, I might refuse to utter or think them even in pretense, refuse to try them out. I may be unable to bring myself to sing the praises of the Nazis, even in pretense, when a fascist poem invites me to do so, just as I might be unable to bring myself to stick pins into the portrait of a loved one. This is an instance of imaginative resistance. Hearing someone else express obnoxious sentiments might be unpleasant, but I would expect to be able to tolerate this a lot more easily than expressing those sentiments myself, pretending to express them sincerely. So we have here a partial explanation of the asymmetry there seems to be between moral and descriptive contents of fictions. There may be no very great difference between our willingness to imagine another person claiming that time travel is possible and our willingness to imagine another person claiming that infanticide for purposes of gender selection is right and proper. But there is a difference between pretending to make these claims myself. I have no trouble at all pretending to assert that time travel is possible, though I will resist pretending to assert that it is perfectly all right to kill babies because of their gender. If or insofar as the point of a work is to put readers in word, to, sorry, if or insofar as the point of a work is to put words in readers' mouths, rather than to have the reader observe a fictional speaker, what is the reader to do if he's unwilling or unable to use the words even in pretense? He might still read the poem, of course, and he might recognize the poem's attempt to get readers to go along, or its invitation to do so. He might also admire and even appreciate the author's skill in expressing obnoxious ideas, her skill as a thought writer. Is this possibility actual? Appropriating the words of a poem or other text for one's own use, seriously or in pretense, is not incompatible with recognizing a narrator, a poetic speaker. Readers probably do both in many instances. Pure cases of thought writing, like the one I sketched a minute ago, pure cases of thought writing are probably rare, maybe even non-existent. But it seems to me that the thought writing function of a poem is sometimes by far the more important one. It may be important to the reader and intended to be important by the poet. Even if somewhere, it may be important to the reader and intended to be so by the poet, even if somewhere in the reader's experience there is an implicit, if not explicit, imagining of or recognition of a serious speaker. If we recognize a narrator of the 23rd Psalm, a poetic speaker, it would probably be its presumed actual author, an historical figure named David. Alternatively, we might recognize a fictional narrator whom we imagine to be using the words seriously without presuming that this fictional narrator is David. The real David might have been just a thought writer. But the adventurer lost hopelessly in a trackless desert who recites the psalm, the 23rd Psalm, in serious desperation is likely to have not the slightest interest in David or whatever predicament he might have been in, or what he might have meant by his words, or in any fictitious speaker. The words are there in the adventurer's memory. He deems them appropriate to his situation, and he uses them. Notice, by the way, that the 23rd Psalm is in the first person. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, and so on. But the adventurer need not take its first-person pronouns to refer to David or to a fictional narrator. I, in his recitation of the psalm, refers to himself, to the person who is reciting it. Think also of political and religious songs. We Shall Overcome, for instance. Sorry about all these American references, but I think I've discovered that you people know probably more about America than I do, so. Think of political and religious songs such as We Shall Overcome, prayers, chants, mantras, and so on. It's unlikely, I should think, that in singing We Shall Overcome at a political rally, people have a substantial interest in another person, the real-life composer of the lines, or a fictional speaker, whom they believe or imagine to express her genuine sentiments by means of them. I doubt that readers or reciters of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, enjoying their fantasy, pay any attention to a fictional character who had an exciting experience on one Christmas Eve, even if they somehow implicitly recognize such a character. And by the way, The Night Before Christmas is also in the first person. What about the purposes of the authors of these texts? 23rd Psalm, We Shall Overcome, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. Did they regard themselves as thought writers? Well, who knows? The origins of the 23rd Psalm are murky, and those of We Shall Overcome, I've discovered, are complicated. But if authors of these texts meant them to be recited or sung repeatedly in religious services or political rallies or ceremonies or ritual events, it would not be unreasonable to speculate that they meant the reciters or singers to use them in expressing their own feelings, that is, the spectators' or the reciters' feelings, or ideas or attitudes. One final group of examples. T-shirt slogans, bumper sticker slogans, such as, and these are American examples again, support our troops, bring them home, which you'll find on bumper stickers. Change you can believe in. And on a philosophy department t-shirt, it works in practice. What about in theory? Another philosophy department, this is from Wellington, New Zealand, t-shirt beyond belief, and that I was told is meant to be very ambiguous. And a third philosophy department t-shirt, Go Gru, which is a local joke for the University of Michigan, because the phrase that you what you say at football games at the University of Michigan, American football games, is Go Blue. Okay. Instead, it's Go Gru. You've got to know some philosophy for that, but it doesn't matter. The composer of such slogans can hardly have anything in mind, but they're being used on automobile bumpers or t-shirts to express thoughts of the driver or the wearer. The composer of the slogan may or may not agree with the sentiments of the slogans he produces. He might just be producing them for the money, knowing that slogans other people want to use are the ones that will sell. In any case, surely he, the slogan composer, does not expect drivers and t-shirt wearers to think of him, the slogan composer, as using the slogans assertively, or to imagine a fictional narrator who does. It seems like these are cases in which the only function of the slogan is likely to be for use by the person who utters it or puts it on a t-shirt or on a bumper sticker on a car. The 23rd Psalm, We Shall Overcome, the Night Before Christmas, and bumper stickers. Quite a collection of things. None of these say anything directly about the early 19th century lyric poems that I mentioned earlier, Keats and Shelley, for instance. But they do show that we have it in us to employ words primarily or even exclusively in thought writing or speech writing modes. I hope I've convinced you that thought writing can be, and probably is in some instances, the primary function of literary works, if not the only function. It's likely to be, in some cases, I think, more important than they're serving as vehicles for the author's actual assertions or for fictional assertions by the narrator. Am I being disrespectful to poets by comparing them to speechwriters? Not at all. The analogy between poets and speechwriters goes only so far, as I mentioned. Poets who serve as thought writers are never, or almost never, mere wordsmiths, and it's not just for their wordsmithing that we admire and appreciate them and their poetry. They, of course, very often have wonderful things to say, as well as wonderful ways of saying them. Poets contribute original ideas, fresh insights, perspectives, or points of view that may be new to the reader, as well as giving readers words with which to understand and explore them. Speechwriters, employed by politicians, are also often more than wordsmiths, no doubt. The words they supply inevitably suggest clarifications and refinements of the client's ideas, and if the client doesn't have any ideas at all, maybe he gets all of his ideas from a speechwriter. I'll bet that happens sometimes. And speechwriters frequently double as advisors who are expected to make substantive proposals about the contents of a speech. But the speechwriter, qua speechwriter, is charged primarily with inventing effective ways of expressing, of communicating to audiences what his client has already decided to say. Poets are under no such restriction. They are free to compose words expressing thoughts that diverge as radically as they like from the preconceptions of likely readers. Contributing new ideas does not have to mean offering them assertively, however. Poets need not mean what they say any more than speechwriters must, although poets often do, of course, mean what they say. Poets' contribution might consist just in making words available for readers to use, even when in using them, readers achieve drastically new insights or find themselves adopting or trying on previously unimagined points of view. The insights, along with the words to express them, would be available even if the words grew on trees. Why poetry in particular? All literary works contain words, words the reader can appropriate for his own use if he chooses. Any text could conceivably be used by a reader to express her thoughts. Is there anything special about poetry or lyric poetry in this regard? In poetry, there's often special emphasis, of course, on how things are said, rather than just what is said. So poems, in contrast to novels, for instance, are especially likely to express thoughts or ideas in a manner the reader will find particularly apt for his expression. There are indications that readers do, in fact, appropriate the words of poems more often than the words of other literary forms. We tend to perform, quote-unquote, perform poems as we read them, to pronounce the words ourselves, sometimes to read them aloud. People memorize poems or parts of them and recite them on other occasions. We are generally much less inclined to repeat and recite passages from novels. Some literary forms, especially theater, are almost inevitably experienced from without. We almost inevitably regard the words spoken by another person, the character of a theatrical piece, even if the character uses poetic verse, as in the case of lots of Shakespeare, of course. Seeing the actor pronounce the words, we can hardly avoid thinking of them as being used assertively by a person other than ourselves. So what I have in mind mainly here is poetry, and in particular poetry when one reads it rather than hears it pronounced. What about music again? Several of the features that distinguish poetry rather sharply from the novel and other literary forms are ones poetry shares with music. I mentioned our tendency to perform poems as we read, to mouth the words ourselves, and the tendency to remember and recite them on later occasions. Listeners sing along with music as they hear it, often, or tap their feet, or sway with the music, dance, or march. Even if we don't actually voice a melody, we may follow along thinking the melody as we listen. I doubt that we do anything much like this very often when we read a novel, or for that matter, when we watch a film, for instance. Listeners also remember previously heard melodies, and on later occasions hum or sing or tap out rhythms. In performing music in these ways, listeners are likely to be using the sound types anyway, or tokens of the types they hear. They are likely to be using the sounds to express their own feelings or emotions they try on, ones they experience at least in imagination. If musical sounds can be heard as someone else's expression, I think sometimes they can, but not always, if musical sounds can be understood as someone else's expression, that of a musical persona, there is no reason why they should not be appropriated by listeners for their own expression, nor is there any reason why they should not function only in this latter way. Using musical sounds or gestures to express one's own feelings is not incompatible with regarding them as expressions of another person, a musical persona. We often do both, no doubt. But we don't need to recognize a persona in order to use the music for our own expressive purposes. We need not take the music to depict or represent itself as someone else's expression. Appropriating musical sounds for one's own use need not involve anything like recognizing or empathizing with another person's expressive behavior. This suggests that musical personae, even when there are such, may not be very central in listeners' experiences. Even if at some level we do recognize a persona, what is important may be just our own expressive use of the sounds that we hear. So musical performances can be understood to present tunes, rhythmic patterns, musical gestures for possible use by the listener, whether or not they also present a persona. Musicians, composers, and performers might intend or expect their music to be so understood. They may serve as something like thought writers. I'm not sure exactly what words to use here. Maybe we should call them gesture writers or expressive behavior indicators or something of the sort. Jennifer Robinson, whom I mentioned earlier, mounts an interesting and elaborate defense of musical personae in much instrumental music. A psychological reading of various musical works is needed, she thinks, for several reasons. For instance, it's needed to make sense of certain apparently anomalous musical events, ones that would not make sense in formal or purely structural terms. I think that she's right about this, but a psychological reading need not include personae. One can hear a musical work as a kind of psychological drama without hearing it as expressing a succession of another person's psychological states. The psychology of the psychological reading might be the listener's own as she performs the music, quote unquote. The listener, rather than a persona, may be the protagonist of the psychological drama. So the explanatory work, she has some other things to say, which I'm not going to mention, but the explanatory work she credits persona with can be accomplished, it seems to me, just as well if we understand the music to be thought writing or expressive behavior indicating. Robinson's new romantic theory of expression does have appreciators recreating themselves, the emotions they recognize in personae, but the appreciator's emotions and their expressing them by means of musical sounds and gestures need not be recreations of another person's emotion or expression. Whether or not listeners do experience music from without, it is their experience from within that I think is central to appreciation, at least of a lot of the romantic music Robinson focuses on. I've emphasized similarities between poetry and music. I'm almost finished. I've emphasized similarities between poetry and music, but I began by acknowledging an apparent difference. Postulating personae or narrators would seem to be far more plausible in lyric poetry than in music. There's hardly any controversy about the presence of narrators in lyric poetry, as I mentioned, but it's anything but obvious that there are personae in music. It was by questioning the apparent inevitability of narrators in lyric poetry that I brought out similarities to music. Differences may remain, however. I have not claimed that lyric poems lack narrators. I have left open the possibility that there are narrators in all of them, nor have I denied that there are personae in music, possibly even most music. But it may be that we recognize narrators more often or more explicitly in poetry than we do persona in music, or in more poems than in musical works. Or maybe poetic narrators are generally more important than musical personae. But both are, I think, less important, less central in appreciators' experiences than philosophers of literature and music, including me, have made them out to be in the past. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this great and enlightening talk. And I have two questions for you related to form. You very much focused on the content of poetry.
Yeah.
Thoughts, ideas, attitudes as the main, as your main focus. And I was wondering, since poetry is some, what's the role of form in your concept? Does it make a difference whether a thought or an attitude is expressed in a sonnet or in free verse? Does linguistic decorum play a role? Say, is there a difference between my mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun and my lover's eyes are not particularly special? And finally, what do you make of poetry that's hermetic on purpose? Does something like, say, to take a famous example, does a text like The Wasteland simply refuse to invite us to identify with any thoughts, ideas, and or attitudes, or does it rather invite us to go to a deeper level and try to find out what the words actually mean and how we can relate to them?
There are lots of different kinds of poetry, obviously, and my main point was just that there seem to be some cases in which the kind of thing I described seems to be likely to happen. As far as form is concerned, form is, of course important because form has a lot to do with how effective or elegantly the expression of certain ideas is. And I suggested that one reason why poetry or some poetry is likely to be appropriated by readers in order to express their own attitudes or attitudes that they imagine having is because it expresses things in a wonderful way. Okay, and there are all different kinds of wonderful ways, and some of them obviously will have something to do with the form. It's of course also true that I mentioned that we often memorize poems and maybe memorize them sort of accidentally and recite them to ourselves later. And I think it's pretty clear that poems that have a fairly simple form with a rhyme scheme and so on are likely to be easier to memorize. I mean, you can remember how the next line, it helps you to remember how the next line is going to end because you know it has to rhyme with the first one. Okay, if that's true. So just that simple sort of formal technique might encourage using poetry in the way I described. But I'm sure that there are lots of poems which are, well, I think it's very important to consider both poems that express ideas that the reader may very well agree with or become to agree with so that the reader can seriously use the words to express his or her own thoughts. But it's also important that in some cases one is encouraged to try on certain thoughts. But I think in the latter part of what you said, you were referring to some kinds of cases where that neither of those might be true. And I'm sure that happens in the case of some poetry as it does in other literature, where you simply can't or won't or don't want to or refuse to go along at all, even in pretense, with what the poet's saying, and the poet is expressing ideas that we are not going to want to express even in pretense for ourselves. And that certainly is likely to be true in a lot of poems. Although it may be, I mean, it could be that because of the form of a poem and so forth, we get the impression that we're supposed to, or maybe almost encouraged to, go along with the sentiment in the poem and use the words of the poem to express our own thoughts when we really don't want to or really can't agree with them. And then there, of course, may be a kind of tension in the reading of them. So does that help? I mean, your question is very well taken. There are lots and lots of different kinds of poems. And as I mentioned in the beginning, this is a possibility, a possible way of reading poems and other literary works as well, for that matter. Even novels or stories could be appropriated. The words of them could be appropriated for our own use. But I think it's a much more important and prominent feature of some kinds of poetry than novels and stories mostly, and also other kinds of poetry. Thanks.
I find the analogy which you have, does it work?
Yes,
I find it very interesting, and it reminds me of a passage I have read in Marcel Proust's A la recherche du temps perdu, when the narrator says that the literary work is just an instrument which gives the reader the possibility to read in himself. That is to make an experience which is his own experience and not the narrator's or the author's experience. It's an instrument which helps him understand something or have an emotion which he or she can have only in himself.
So I thought I was being a little bit original, but I see I've been scooped by Proust. So,
but I
forget about what I said. Just go read Proust.
No, I think there remains to be asked something. And this is what I'm going to do. Although I find it correct in a way, what you have said, I think there is an aspect which you haven't considered, and that is the object character of the text or the work, the literary work, which we use when we try to identify with it. We may take elements of it in order to identify or to put them into our own lives, but we still bear in mind that we have this object. It's a poem of Keats, or it's a drama by Shakespeare, or it's a novel. So we still know that there is this object character of the work of art, and we assume that there is someone speaking, even if it's a hypothesis. We do not know who is speaking. You are right, I think, but we still assume it. So what do you make of this object character of literary communication, which makes it possible to communicate?
I'm not sure I fully understand what you mean by an object character, but it's certain. Let me say a couple things, and then you can see if whether I'm speaking to your question or not. It's certainly true that when we read a poem, even if what I said is, even in the kind of pure case that I described, which is going to be probably unusual, we know that somebody wrote the poem. I mean, there are exceptions, maybe. There's computer-written poetry and so forth, where there's not even a thought writer, okay, but just a computer program. But in all the other cases, we know at least that there's a poet involved, and that is certainly important. It doesn't mean that we have to think of the poet as anything but a thought writer, although usually he'll probably be more than a thought writer, but we don't have to think of him that way. He's presenting words to us, and the words are important. And we are interested in probably, well, if nothing else, we are interested in the poet's ability and talents and so forth as a thought writer. That is, we might, one response that we might have to the poem is we might be blown away with admiration for the ability of the poet to express certain thoughts in such an absolutely wonderful and elegant manner. We could be blown away by that, really admiring the poet for that, even if we don't think that the poet was seriously asserting things, or even if we don't imagine that someone was asserting certain things, even if we think of the poet only as a thought writer, still, he might be a very, very wonderful thought writer. We may admire his ability to do that. In fact, this is something we can do even in cases in which I might refuse to or be unable to either use the word seriously myself or pretend to use them seriously myself. I still might be admiring the thought writer for his ability to express these horrible thoughts, if that's what I think they are, in such a wonderful way. So now, I don't know if that's, I mean, the object that you had in mind was the poem, though, right? Not the poet. And, but in thinking of the poet in this way, I'm thinking of the object as being a wonderful thing created by the poem, by the poet. So does that speak to your question? I'm not sure.
Yes, that's it. But then where is the analogy which you made up with the speechwriter? The speechwriter is not admired for his speech as a creator.
Oh, the speechwriter might
be. You just take the speech and pronounce it, perform it, and you don't think of the speechwriter, but you think of the thought writer.
Oh, I think I might.
Poetry.
I mean, if I hire a speechwriter, I may be very interested in whether the speechwriter is talented or not, and how well he's able or she's able to produce words that I'll want to use in my political campaign or whatever. And so I might very well be interested in the speechwriter. It's probably true that the purpose of the speechwriter is, the benefit I gain from looking at the work of a speechwriter probably is not going to especially involve my admiration for his ability, because if you hire a speechwriter, you're mainly interested in what you're going to say in your speech. So the kind of pleasure that I think you might get in admiring a poet, a thought-writing poet, may be unlikely to be something that you're especially interested in if you're getting a speech written by a speechwriter. But it's something you could be interested in. In addition to using the speech in your political campaign, you might just be blown away by the talent and the ability of a speechwriter to be able to put exactly what you want to say in such wonderful form. I mean, it's banal and it's naive and it's stupid, but he made it sound, the speechwriter made it sound really profound and wonderful. And not only does that mean I can give a great speech, even with horrible content, but I might really be pleased by the ability of the speechwriter and might really enjoy the fact that he did such a good job.
So why not go for the speechwriter if you learned that Obama's wonderful speeches were not written by himself, but by some whiz-kid in the back, ghostwriter? Why not elect the ghostwriter, the speechwriter?
Well, maybe we should. But you might want two different qualities in somebody you vote for. One is a quality of having good policies and asserting the right kinds of declarative sentences, that is, about what you're going to do when you're elected and so forth. And you might also want to vote for somebody who has a mastery of the English language and can speak English, if you're in America, or German if you're in Germany. And you may have a problem because your speechwriter might have one of these qualities and the client, the politician, might have the other quality. So, but of course, we often don't know exactly how much of the speech was written by the politician and how much was not. And that's, of course, one of the things that we have to guess at when we vote.
I have two questions about your concept of thought writing, which I think sounds very intriguing, but I'm not quite sure I understand every aspect about it yet. The first question is, what do you mean when you say that you think very often there are mixed functions? There's a function of experience from within, but also from without. Do you mean that there are different readings and different situations, and texts are sometimes read as if from within and sometimes as if from without? Or do you mean that somehow in the same reading, both aspects could play a role? That would be something that I would find much harder to understand or imagine. Well, and, maybe answer that first and I'll ask a second question.
It could, of course, be different readings, but I think it can also be the same reading. And in fact, that's how I understand the article by R.K. Eliot, which I mentioned. The idea there, as I interpret him, and he's not quite as explicit as he could be, but what I take from him is the idea that, in the first place, you read the poem and you understand it as the speech, the expressive speech of another person, of the poetic speaker or the fictional narrator, maybe of the poet. But then you empathize with that person. And in empathizing with that person, you, in imagination, put yourself in his shoes or her shoes, and you then imagine using the words yourself to express your own feelings. So it's a matter of, I mean, this is, of course, what empathy is. You recognize another person as behaving in certain ways or having certain thoughts and feelings and so forth, and you also in imagination put yourself in that person's shoes and yourself feel something similar. And in this case, as I emphasized, it's got to be empathy with the expression of the thoughts and feelings by means of the words and text, but not just empathy with the feelings themselves. So I understand somebody else to be saying things, but maybe I am expressing certain thoughts, but I hang on every word and maybe mouth the words myself as I hear them and say yes, 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 yes to myself. And so I am myself then using those words in my own mind to express my own thoughts, perhaps, at the same time that I understand someone else to be doing it. So, yeah, I think so. I think these two things can coincide, can be occur in the same reading, but they don't have to. I was, of course, emphasizing that the second one, the thought writing form or the thinking of them as your own expression, doesn't require the other, and that was my main point. But I think they are compatible. They can happen at the same time. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Second question is about what you said about lyrical poems.
About what?
Lyrical poems. Why are lyric poems so often used for thought writing? Does this have anything to do with sort of the fact that they don't use any specific places, names, times, and so on. So would you say that this experiencing from within happens much more often in texts where you don't have that sort of feeling of a specific setting, person?
Whatever. Yeah, I think that's right. It might just be that we're more likely to... I mean, if you have a poem describing, a trip to Croatia by someone who met a certain person, and this is maybe related to the Richard Corey example, and and if you're not in Croatia at the time, you can't at the time maybe use the words of the poem seriously to express your own thoughts because you know you're not there, and the thoughts are something about being in Croatia and seeing the Adriatic and so forth and so on. You could imagine all of that, of course, and that's what I described in the case of the Richard Corey poem, which is about a fictional particular incident in which there's a gentleman named Richard Corey, and he's being observed by the street people on the sidewalk and so forth. And I did suggest, and I think it's true, that one can imagine being in that situation and so forth. But sure, we're much more likely to seriously use the words to express thoughts that we really have if the thoughts are not tied to some particular place and time and object and so forth, which might not be something that we are actually experiencing. So, good.
Yeah, thank you once again for a very thought-inspiring lecture. A lot to think about. I'm not quite sure whether I agree with everything you've said, but then again, that's probably not necessary either. I'd like to come back to the idea of appropriation and ask once again two questions. The first one, or the first allusion rather than a question, you're probably aware of Michael Bakhtin or Mikhail Bakhtin and his concept of heteroglossia, which is also dealing in appropriation. And he would say, whenever you take somebody else's words, you take the whole lifestyle. So there is no such thing as simply appropriating and being yourself in expressing those words, which would run counter to your idea of being able to do that. How would you position yourself towards Bakhtin? And the second thing is when you make the opposition of imagining a speaker and thought writing, appropriating the words, I wonder if that is not, if this really is an opposition, or if it is not a difference in degree rather than kind. Is it not that we can only appropriate what we can also think of as being said by somebody? Basically, it's based on what Monika Fludenik calls experientiality as one feature of narrative, the ability to be able to experience something like that as one prerequisite for narrating. Yeah. And so that would mean that we can only appropriate what we could imagine or what we have first imagined when we read it as somebody else speaking it, and then we can take over. So that the two sides are really two sides of one coin that hinges on our imagining somebody spoke those words. It might be Goethe, it might be me, it might be Werther or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of questions there. I did leave out one section in which I considered a possible objection, which I think is related to the one you're raising, your second point, about, you might put it this way, how can I appropriate the words for myself, use them in imagination or really to express my own thoughts, unless I know what they mean, okay, and that what they mean involves not just the semantics of the language, but the context and so forth and so on. And then the idea might be, in order to know that, I've got to think of them as having been uttered by somebody else, okay, somebody else in a certain particular context or whatever. And I think my answer to that is just, well, it certainly is true that in order to understand in an appropriate sense the meaning of the words, what they're trying to get across, what propositions they express, and so forth, you have to consider not just the marks themselves on the page and the sounds, and not just the semantic and syntactic properties, but the contextual relations and so forth and so on. But that doesn't mean that we have to think of somebody else using them. I could find those words and use them myself, utter the words myself, and then what they mean in this broad sense will be connected with my own situation, my own context, and so forth. So, in other words, yes, it may be that to understand in this broad sense what the words mean, I've got to think of them as being spoken, okay, or being uttered by somebody. But the person I think of them as being uttered by might be me. I don't see why it has to be somebody else. As far as Bhaktin is concerned, it does sound as though we probably disagree. And if that's so, then that's true. But I'm sure that you know Bhaktin much better than I do, and I should take a look at it and see carefully what he's saying. But okay.
It seems to me that there's a particular advantage of imagining listening to a fictional speaker, and here is it. Suppose you're a very polite person, then in your game of make-believe, it would be fictional that you listen to all of the things he has to say, because you're polite and you wouldn't just stop, although he's still speaking. With your approach, it's different. You just pick out the things that you might find interesting and which are suited to sort of express your own feelings. So you advance sort of a very brutal sort of appreciation that is sort of chops pieces out of the artwork, whereas imagining a fictional speaker, provided you're a polite person and imagine yourself listening to all he says, is the opposite. So this would be an advantage.
I didn't mean to be advancing much of anything, actually. I meant to be pointing out a possibility, which I think is actual, I think which is one interesting and good thing that we often do with poems, but I certainly didn't mean to be saying that in general that's what we ought to be doing with poems. And also, of course, it is sometimes picking out bits and pieces, and that is actually what I described that we often do in when we pick up pithy phrases and so forth with from other people's conversation. I mean, someone might use a certain pithy phrase in a certain context, and I might not care at all about the context, and just find, hey, that's a neat phrase, I'll use it for myself, and just forget about the other person. There might not even really be any communication. And that might be not a very nice thing to do, and so on. But in the cases of some poetry, we sometimes take a whole poem or a whole verse or something or other and use that. It doesn't have to be bits and pieces. But again, we can do both, and we might have enough interest in the other person, in the poet, or in the poetic speaker, the narrator, or whatever, to really pay attention to that person, and nevertheless find ourselves maybe in agreement and wanting to use the same words to express our own thoughts as well. And in fact, of course, this might be, when both of these things happen at once, it might be an important way of feeling at one with the poet. That is, the poet or the narrator or whoever used these words to express certain thoughts, and I might be so taken up with it, so much in agreement, that I use the same words myself, and knowing they're the same words and thinking of them as both words that the other person used to express the thoughts or ideas and ones that I want to use, we're one, okay? We're on the same team or whatever. That can happen too.
Much as I liked your talk, I enjoyed it very much. It also gets me into trouble, and you didn't want that, and so you're going to help me solve this problem. Until tonight, it was my intention, actually, once the Frias was built and I could get back to work, to write a little book on lyrical self-representation. On poetry, that is of an autobiographical nature, makes use of the poet's own name and clearly refers to situations in the poet's biography, life, and so on. There are very famous examples, and I actually sort of looking forward to this project. I collected quite a nice collection of poets that that fulfill this requirement of saying I, mentioning the proper name. Ich, Bertolt Brecht, bin aus den schwarzen Wäldern. I, Bertolt Brecht, was born in the Black Forest, and so on. And there is a sizable collection of this kind of poetry. Now, even though I'd admit that still empathy plays a major role in reading these poets, this kind of poetry, I can identify with gestures or roles offered by these poems, I would still believe that in that case I would have to take an authorial role, a persona whatsoever, into consideration, and that is that I could not easily abstract from this kind of expressive intention by an author, by a poet, to, in a few lines of a poem, sum up his own, her own life, which is a life distinct from that of her or his readers. What about this kind of, this type of poetry?
Well, I don't think you have a problem at all. It sounds to me like the poems you have in mind are ones which may or may not be reasonable to for the reader to use for his own purposes, but maybe less likely for that to happen, but maybe are almost inevitably experienced from without. That is, Bertolt Brecht's name is in the poem, and it may be knowing that there is a Bertolt Brecht and being interested in that person and so forth, it may be almost inevitable that you think of the poem as expressing his thoughts and so forth. And that that's certainly happens in a lot of cases. And it may very well be that that's the only reasonable way of understanding these poems. I mean, there may be something of an empathy going on, but maybe not nearly as much or nearly as important experiencing from within as I suggested there might be in some of the special cases like the lyric poems and so forth that I had in mind. So.
Well, thank you. You rescued my project. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention. Thank you for coming. All those interested in getting to know Kendall Walton a lot closer, you know that there is a two-day workshop starting tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Formally, you had to inscribe, sign up for it. It's not too late. It would still be okay to accept a few of you into the workshop. It would, of course, mean that you would read all night because there are the reading assignments. But that could be done, I assume. It's only about 120 pages or so. So that could be done. Thank you all for coming. And, see some of you tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Thank you, Ken, for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you very much.